We are live. Welcome back once again. It is Friday, August 7th, and this is my Own the Shoulders of Giants YouTube channel. For those who don't know, I am Joseph Ward, the founder, author, and creator of On the Shoulders of Giants. I've been doing On the Shoulders of Giants for about, since 2014. And I started doing this because I came across a group of young black children who had no idea who Harriet Tubman. And that right there don't sit right with me. So I made sure I created On the Shoulders of Giants to provide stories of the unsung heroes of the African diaspora, African history at your fingertips, and little known black history, unknown black culture, all those different things. I do my best to find the information and expose you to it and find others who know the information and be able to expose you to it. So that's another reason why we're here today. So you can check out my website at www.ontheshoulders1.com, as you see on the screen. And if you would like to support me, you can go to patreon.com/OTSOG, and you can support me on Patreon as well. And just, you know, once again, thank you for everybody being here. Thank you for all the support. Thank you for tuning in. Please make sure you like this video, comment, subscribe, make sure you share it, because that definitely helps the analytics and everything move forward and get more people to view this video. So like, comment, subscribe, and share. All right, so today is a great one, because this gentleman that's on the screen with me, I met him when he was around 21 to 22 years old. It was unexpected meeting when I first met him, because I was invited to a gathering, and the intention was to connect with another young man. And I did connect with that young man, but I started talking history with this young man, and we were just talking for hours about certain history. And at the age of 22, I was, 30, maybe 30 at the time. He's 22, and he knew more history of Tallahassee. Like, he knows it like the back of his hand. But I was overly impressed at such a young age how thorough he was with history, how informed and studied he was with history. Over the years, he's created an organization called the National Association for the Preservation of African American History and Culture. And that organization is dedicated to preserving African American history, historical sites, and just all types of aspects that go with Black history, untold Black history, or Black history that's covered up. His name is Deletra Hollinger. So he's the founder of the National Association for the Preservation of African American History and Culture. He's a stout historian. He's definitely a beacon in our Tallahassee community. And I welcome him to my Own Shoulders of Giants channel. What's up, man?
How you doing, Joe? I appreciate you inviting me.
Oh, man, I appreciate you for being here, and I appreciate you for everything that you bring to the table, man. Also, like I was saying, you put me on to a lot of Tallahassee history, Black history in Tallahassee. And I like the fact that Black preservation is something that you are stout on, and just everything you bring to the table, man. You're a dynamic young man, so I'm always going to do what I have to do or do what I can to help you out.
I appreciate it.
No problem, man. So let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
Kind of give the people some background information about yourself. Let's start there. Who are you, and just how you got to this point where you are now?
Well, I'm Deletra Hollinger, native of Tallahassee, born and raised in Tallahassee, Florida. I'm fifth generation. My great-great grandparents were slaves on Leontine soil. So the interest actually in history came when I was about 2 years old. I remember my mom had bought a whole collection of books, but they were on some of our Black heroes, like Mary McLeod Bethune, Benjamin Banneker, W.E.B. Du Bois. And so really from like the age of 2 years old to now, the desire to learn that history and to preserve it more recently has just grown, and it's just gotten greater and greater. So a little bit about me. I founded the organization NAPAC in 2013, so about 7 years ago. And, you know, we've been doing some great work ever since. As you know yourself as a board member, you know, trying to do what we can to protect and preserve not only historic properties, but stories. Because, you know, every time one of our ancestors passes away, you know, all of the stories, all of the memories and that legacy goes with them. It is not recorded.
Right.
I know that we worked on a project a few years back where we were recording and interviewing a lot of our local heroes, a lot of whom are even from the people that we interview who are no longer here. So it's really, really important. It's extremely important because it's up to us. It's up to our generation to make sure that those stories are told, to put it on paper, to publish the books, and to keep putting it in front of people's faces. And once you put it in front of people's faces, then it's on them at that point, because we all, every single one of us, have an obligation. Once we know it, it's one thing not to know it, but once we know it and once we have that knowledge, then we have that obligation to protect and preserve the stories, the memories of these people, and the legacy. So that's just a small bit about me. I was I've been active in the community for about 12 years, I would say, since I was about 14 years old, working on different projects. One of the most recent projects that was instrumental in working on was designating Orange Avenue to the memory of the Reverend T.K. Steele. And so now one of our major roadways that goes from one end of Tallahassee to the other is dedicated in honor of the Reverend C.K. Steele, who was really a giant in not only the city of Tallahassee, but really throughout the nation and the world. He was a very well-known civil rights giant leader. And so really just working on making sure the history of our community, but also of other communities, is preserved has been something I've been working on. I also served as a president of our local NAACP branch here in Tallahassee, and actually was the youngest president in our branch's history.
Yeah, you were.
At that time at 24 years old. And so that was an honor. It was an honor really just to follow in the footsteps of people like the Reverend C.K. Steele and Dan Speed and the Reverend R.N. Gooden and people like Anita Davis and Dr. Charles Evans. So just that alone, to know that they had occupied that seat before me, you know, that was an honor. Those are really some true giants in our community. So now I'm like everybody else. We're trying to get through COVID, but also COVID, I think, has given us an opportunity to focus and concentrate, write those books that we ain't had a chance to write. And just really focus on some things that we're trying to do.
Okay. Definitely. Definitely. So I do want to go further into Reverend C.K. Steele, because I want to kind of have you give some of the stories of Reverend C.K. Steele, also Reverend R.N. Gooden. But before we get to that, NAPAC, I want people to know more about NAPAC as well. So kind of give us a breakdown of NAPAC, how it started, why you started it, and just more information, the website and everything. Well, it's right here, but all the information about NAPAC.
Well, The National Association for the Preservation of African American History and Culture started because all over the country, really between 2010 and 2013, I started to see a lot of historic buildings, historic mm-hmm. Black neighborhoods here in Tallahassee, but also elsewhere that were being gentrified, that were being mm-hmm. destroyed. And, you know, once you tear down a building, that building is gone. You know, some things you can come back from, but once you destroy a historic church that's been standing for 150 years, or once you tear down a house or a building or a school that's been somewhere for over a century, that's meant so much to our people and our legacy, that's gone forever. So that resonated with me. That really resonated with me. And it made me really want to do something about it, because it was happening at such an alarming rate in neighborhoods and across the country, and still is. So I wanted to create an organization that would really serve as an advocacy organization. Like, even if we didn't have any money, if we didn't have any paid staff, if we didn't have any contributions coming in, I thought there needed to at least be an advocacy nonprofit organization that could send letters, make telephone calls, gather up other concerned citizens who would contact local government or developers or whoever to try to say, look, you know, this building, A, B, and C happened here. 1, 2, 3. One of the most important ones I think that we worked on, Joseph, was the old Leon County jail is now demolished. That was a project that we worked on with NAPAC for 4 years, really to try to let people know that this jail, this is where the first civil rights jail-in took place. Mm-hmm. The first jail-in in the country, in the nation, when the students from HBCUs and PWIs across the country started sitting in at lunch counters segregated. Tallahassee was, our students were the first to go to jail, yes, and to refuse to pay fines for that, because they felt that if they paid the fines, they'd be paying for segregation. In Greensboro, North Carolina, mm-hmm. you had these student senators in North Carolina, but they paid the fines. Well, our students in Tallahassee, Florida A&M and FSU said, we're not paying for segregation, so you all can incarcerate us and we will stay here. And so they served out their jail sentences. That was really significant. That was the first time that had ever happened in anywhere in the United States. And so even the Tallahassee bus boycott, you know, they arrested Reverend C.K. Steele numerous times. The two students from Florida A&M, Wilhelmina Jakes and Kara Patterson, who had been arrested for refusing to give up their seats in 1956. Mm-hmm. The Tallahassee bus boycott, which came along 5 months after the Montgomery bus boycott, was mm-hmm. the second most successful bus protest in the country. And that made national headlines. The student sit-ins made national headlines. I know we just lost Congressman John Lewis, who was instrumental in the Voting Rights Act and in what happened in Selma when the state troopers attacked demonstrators. But there was also an incident here in Tallahassee many people don't know about that occurred on March the 12th of 1960, there were some student sit-ins taking place downtown. About 8 FSU and FAMU students were arrested. And so Patricia Stevens Due went back to campus and she got together about 1,800 students in total. I think that about a group of a few hundred students were trying to march downtown to the jail on one side. I think present day Wanish Way. And then there was a group of about 1,000 that was trying to march on Adam Street and FAMU Way, where the railroad tracks are. And but that group was, the other group was attacked with bats by the White Citizens Council. The second group of about 1,000 students was met by state troopers and Tallahassee police officers, who, very similar to Selma, asked them to disperse, and so they started throwing tear gas bombs into the crowd. This was covered in newspapers all over the country. Mm-hmm. It was in, there were pictures of it in Jet Magazine. And this is actually when Patricia Stevens Dew suffered permanent damage to her eyesight, because a police officer recognized her and threw a tear gas bomb into her eyes. So, you know, we have had our own nationally significant events right here in the state capital of Florida. And I think that whereas you had other states like Alabama and Mississippi who had openly racist governors, you know, we had Leroy Collins, who was more of a moderate when it came to civil rights. As a matter of fact, shortly after the incident I just discussed with you, he came on television and said that it was morally wrong to have segregation. And so that was well received by civil rights leaders. So there was not a governor in the United States that was talking like that at that time. You know, we had we had George Wallace in Alabama, who was standing in the schoolhouse door, and these other governors in Mississippi who would not protect civil rights demonstrators. So and then the Civil Rights Act of 1964, I'm gonna say this and then I'm gonna get back to your question.
You could.
That the Civil Rights Act was passed because of what happened in Florida, because Dr. Robert Haling, a dentist out of St. Augustine, who had been born and raised in Tallahassee, his father was a professor at FAMU. Mm-hmm. The Haling House is still standing on Young Street. Dr. Haling was the leader of the civil rights movement in St. Augustine. He called Dr. King because it was so much turmoil going on in St. Augustine that he had Dr. King and Andrew Young, Reverend C.K. Steele, Ralph Abernathy, and others to come to St. Augustine. And Dr. King said himself that St. Augustine, Florida, was the most lawless place he had ever been to. More lawless than Alabama, more lawless than Mississippi. So Dr. King said, this is it. He said, this is the place we need to be to make sure that we get this legislation passed in Congress. And sure enough, they caused so much hell in St. Augustine that that Johnson didn't have a choice but to sign the Civil Rights Act in 1964. So to address your earlier statement, I don't think people really understand or know or have been taught the significance of what happened in Tallahassee and in Florida as a whole. And so and we don't have we don't have a statewide institution dedicated to telling that story. We have several African-American museums throughout Florida that exist to tell the story of African Americans and what took place in those specific towns and cities, but we don't have something to really tell the story holistically of what happened in the state of Florida. So so that's a part of it. But NAPAC as an organization, you know, we're committed to preserving the history. There are several, like for instance, last year, when I had the opportunity to appear on a radio show with, I was invited by our mayor pro tem here in Tallahassee, Commissioner Diane Williams Cox, invited me to appear on a radio show. I appeared with Mrs. Altamise Barnes, who founded the Riley House, And there was a caller. There was a caller who asked us if we had ever heard of a cemetery for slaves existing at the Capital City Country Club. And I seem to, and when he said
Right.
this, it brought my mind back to seeing a newspaper article when I was doing some research from 2001. Miss Anita Davis was president of the NAACP, and she had gotten with the city commissioner, Dr. Charles Billings, who was in office at that time, to research this. But it seemed like it didn't go anywhere at the time. So I thought it was important to bring that issue back up to the city,
right,
and say, you know, we need to do some further research on this. But long story short, the National Park Service ended up coming in and doing a GPR survey and found mm-hmm. that indeed those slaves are in fact buried at the Capital City Country Club. And so it's things like that. It's things like that.
Right. Right.
Is why NAPAC exists, because we got to bring right. dignity to those brothers and sisters that were buried at the Capital City Country Club. We got to bring dignity to the cemetery project that I actually just got involved in, because there was a lady on my Facebook page that got in touch with me a few weeks ago, and she told me that there was a cemetery behind her house that was grown up and so hesitantly I agreed to go with her, because I didn't know what was back. Well, you know,
right.
But we in the Jake Gaither neighborhood, between Springsex Park and Notre Dame Street,
mm-hmm.
There are a bunch of trees and woods. But back up in those
right,
trees
right.
and woods are the graves of Black folks that are over 100 years old.
Hold up, time out, time out, time. Hold on, time out. Like, right. for real? Like, no, because I was just over there. No, like, seriously. And the reason why you see the shock on my face is, remember when we did the interviews with Miss Laura Dixie? You know, she lives,
yeah.
like, you can walk from her house there. And I spent a lot of time over there because mm-hmm. I'm best friends with her grandson. And
it's literally across the street
right,
from Miss Dixie's
right,
house.
By that big ditch.
Right. Across the street from Miss Dixie's house, you see trees. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In those woods are marked graves for
wow.
African Americans. The oldest of which, the most legible headstone, is 1914.
Wow.
So you have people who and see those houses, a lot of those houses weren't even built until the 1950s. The houses on Miss Dixie Street, which is, I think is Tanner Drive, and then the houses on Notre Dame Street,
right.
those houses weren't even built until the 1950s. And so this cemetery, which is associated with Fountain Chapel AME Church, has to date back to the 1800s, because Fountain Chapel AME Church was founded in 1880 in that area. So I'm quite certain that they started burying people in their cemetery shortly after the church was
mm-hmm.
founded. So you're talking about a cemetery that date back to the 1800s that's grown up
right.
with trees and woods that have headstones. The last burial took place, I think, in 1966. The earliest burial that we know of, because of headstone evidence, 1914. And
right.
That's the kind of stuff. That's why I founded the organization, right there. That's a perfect example. That's a perfect example, because it just shows how we as a community have been marginalized over the years. And it shows how we are still being marginalized in many ways, because
we are,
you know, because even my great great grandparents, my great great grandmother specifically, her name was Mary Bell Isler. She's buried in the Old City Cemetery downtown mm-hmm. on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, And but she's buried in the black section in the back of the cemetery.
I didn't know that had a black I didn't know there was a black section.
It's a black section of the Old City Cemetery in the back, and some of the most prominent black names in Tallahassee history are buried there. Nim, Riley, M.B. Young, who was the longest serving and second president of Florida A&M University. He left Tallahassee to serve as president of the HBCU Lincoln University, but he requested that he be buried in Tallahassee. He's buried there. A lot of famous African-Americans in Florida and Tallahassee are buried there, but the cemetery was segregated. And in 1936, the city commission voted not to allow the burials of African Americans any longer in city cemeteries. And so that forced J.R.D. Laster and John G. Riley and other African American community leaders at the time to start their own cemetery, Greenwood Cemetery. Well, in the 1980s, when Dorothy Inman Johnson was serving as our first African-American female city commissioner and mayor, she was approached by some of our more prominent community leaders to do something about the state of Greenwood Cemetery at that time. And so the city ended up taking over the maintenance of Greenwood Cemetery after the community got together and cleaned it up. So that's an example of an injustice that was done, but was later many years corrected.
So I got a question.
Go ahead.
And this it gonna veer a bit, but you talked about renaming Orange Avenue the CK Steele Highway. What was the process that took to get the highway renamed after CK Steele, and like was it a lot of pushback going through that process, or when you initiated having the highway or the road renamed to CK Steele Highway?
There was no pushback, but there was nothing but support. But the thing about that is the legislation, because Orange Avenue, half of Orange Avenue from South Monroe Street to Capitol Circle Southwest is a state road. And because that section is a state road, it had to go through the Florida legislature. And so representative or former state representative Alan Williams was the one who proposed that. We had a conversation and he put it in. He termed out of the legislature in 2016. So Ramon Alexander and State Senator Bill Mumford had to continue to push it because we could not get a transportation facility designation bill out of the House and Senate in 2015. There was not one passed in 2017. And in 2016. And then in 2017, when they finally passed the transportation facility designations bill, it didn't include the CK Steele designation. And I was very disappointed because at that point, we had been working for 3 years. And so in 2018, Senator Mumford put it back in there again. And thankfully, committee substitute for Senate Bill 382. Was signed by governor on March 23rd, 2018, and so that's how we were able to get that state road named in honor to Reverend C.K. Steele. Now Reverend Steele's son, his son who was still alive at the time, Darryl Steele, also former County Commissioner Bob Ratcliffe came to me and said that they thought that Reverend Steele really deserved, you know, the entirety of the role. So the other issue that we ran into at that time was, okay, we got the part of the road that's owned by the state of Florida named after 4 years of putting bills in. Now we got to see who owns the other part of that street. So Orange Avenue, South Monroe to South Blairstone is owned by Leon County, and South Blairstone all the way out to Southwood Plantation Road is the city of Tallahassee. So Leon County moved expeditiously to designate their portion, and then the city moved expeditiously to designate their portion. So that's how that came about. So really it took 4 years to get that done.
Okay. And for those who are not familiar with Tallahassee, it is we're talking about Orange Avenue, and Orange Avenue is one of the main roads on the south side of Tallahassee. Tallahassee is one of the most segregated cities as far as black and white in the United States. And we are literally divided by railroad tracks. So everything on the north side of town basically is white people's side, and everything on the south side is black people's side. And Orange Avenue is a main road on the black side of town. So it was very important to have the road named after Reverend C.K. Steele. Now, I did a video on Reverend C.K. Steele here on this on the Soldier Giants YouTube channel. So I encourage all of you all to go watch that video, like, comment, and subscribe. But Delatri, can you give us more information on C.K. Steele, kind of some of the stories about C.K. Steele that helped cement his legacy as a true freedom fighter?
Sure. Well, Reverend Steele came from Bluefield, West Virginia, and he started preaching really, really, really early when he was about 15 years old, I believe. And he went to Montgomery, Alabama. He went to various cities in Georgia preaching, and he went to Morehouse College. He graduated from Morehouse College in 1938 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in religion. And somewhere along the way, he met Dr. King. I believe he met Dr. Mm-hmm. King in Alabama when he was preaching in Alabama. I think that's when they met. They became really, really close friends. And Reverend Steele was quite actively involved in civil rights on a national level then. So he and Dr. King became close. And so he eventually was called to pastor Bethel Missionary Baptist Church in 1952, and at the time it was on Boulevard Street. In 1952, the church had a parsonage, and in fact, Bethel Missionary Baptist Church is the oldest African American church in Leon County, and so he came to pastor that church in 1952. His first order of business when he came to Tallahassee in 1952 was to get Tallahassee his first black police officer, which he was able to do successfully that same year with working with Reverend Dr. James Hudson and Father David Brooks, who pastored St. Michael and All Angels Episcopal Church, and also the Reverend Dan Speed. So they worked to get Tallahassee its first black police officer, subsequently working with Dr. King on the Montgomery bus boycott, and doing a lot of traveling, a lot of the most important civil rights events that people know about all over the country. C.K. Steele was there, but C.K. Steele was not a clout chaser or a camera chaser. So a lot of times when you see Reverend Steele in the pictures with Dr. King, he either is, you know, looking over somewhere, or his head is peeking out from behind somewhere, because even though he was on that bridge in Selma, and even though he was at the March on Washington, and even though he was in St. Augustine, he wasn't necessarily trying to be seen. He was trying to fight for the call. So even though he was there when you did catch him, you know, he was peeking out from somewhere. But so the success of Montgomery in 1955 and the arrest of the two FAMU students in 1956, Reverend Steele decided to the ministers, the black ministers in Tallahassee, asked him to serve as president of the Intercivic Council. The reason they started the Intercivic Council as the organization that would lead the Tallahassee bus boycott is because Alabama and Florida were trying to outlaw the NAACP in their respective states as an organization, because members of the Florida legislature and Alabama legislature at the time said that the NAACP was sending people into their respective communities to be troublemakers. So they started an organization of their own made up of local people, the Intercivic Council, that would lead the efforts of the bus boycott. Now, the bus boycott was a turbulent time for Tallahassee. But eventually, there were some riots that were averted. There was a planned protest downtown in 1956 to test bus segregation that was called off because there were a group of whites downtown who had hammers hidden in brown paper bags, and they had planned to start a riot. And so Governor Leroy Collins at the time suspended bus service in Tallahassee. Significant, I think, is when you watch video from that time period, there is a building. The buses at that time were they were privately. It was a private company called Cities Transit Incorporated. Cities Transit.
Okay.
The building that Cities Transit was located in, where they parked all the buses, is actually still standing in Cascades Park. It was actually across the street from our local jail. But he suspended bus service for a time. But when it resumed, there was a ruling that was issued by a federal judge out of Miami to desegregate buses. And so when Reverend C.K. Steele and the Reverend A.C. Reed, Reverend H. McNeil Harris, who was pastor of Bethel AME Church at the time, they got on the bus and to test the bus segregation. And sure enough, the buses had been integrated. But that was just the start of things. And so, so Reverend Steele continued to work for civil rights nationally, but also here at home. He would host people in his parsonage, like Constance Baker Motley and Thurgood Marshall, who were NAACP attorneys. And of course, they were instrumental in integrating many of the universities throughout the South. And many other things. And of course, I think in 1961 or so, Reverend Steele had invited Dr. King to Tallahassee, because 1960, 1961 was during the time we had student sit-ins. And actually, Reverend Steele took on the role of an advisor when the student sit-ins started in 1960, because they were being led really by the students who were leading the core chapter here in Tallahassee, the Congress of Racial Equality. And so he would go downtown to advise the students, but he would also be participating in the sit-ins and in the pickets, carrying the picket signs and the protest signs downtown. If the students got arrested, they would bring food to the jail. And that kind of thing. But he also continued to be active nationally. There was a group that got arrested in 1961 during the Freedom Riots called the Tallahassee Ten. The Tallahassee Ten were a group of ministers who came to Tallahassee from all over the country to try and integrate the Tallahassee Airport. When they did so, they were arrested. But for some reason, the trial went all the way up to 1964. And they actually returned to Tallahassee in 1964 to 10 ministers to serve out their jail sentences. But they ended up only serving a few days before they were released. But Reverend Steele, Freedom Rise, integrating the airport. One of his children actually, he filed a lawsuit against the Leon County School Board because Brown versus Board had happened in 1954. So Reverend Steele was the one who filed the lawsuit here in Leon County to desegregate our local school system, which really started taking place between 1964 and 1965. Also, he was instrumental in the voting rights movement, traveling to Alabama, traveling to D.C. and different other places to so that he could participate, because he was serving as the executive vice president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which Dr. King was president of. And so with Dr. Steele being executive vice president, that kept him out of town often on business. But the civil rights movement that was fought here in Tallahassee was largely done so under the leadership of Reverend Steele and the Reverend R.N. Gooden. Certainly, as you move into the 1970s, they continue to fight, because a lot of iniquities continue, you know, past the 60s, past the Civil Rights Act, past the Voting Rights Act, past the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And the last battle he fought was getting Boulevard Street renamed to Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. And when they did it the first time, it was done from Brevard Street to through the FAMU campus, because the other side, the other side of the street would not be renamed until the 1990s, because that part of the community was not interested at that time in having a Boulevard Street named for Dr. King. So so at the time, Reverend Steele said, "We'll come back next year, and we'll get the other half of it." But before that could happen, he passed away. So that happened in April of 1980. But he fought many battles here in Tallahassee, filed many lawsuits, participated in many sit-ins and marches and acts of protest. Even when he got really, really sick with the bone marrow cancer, you know, he would still march with his cane, and he would get up on Sundays at his church and he would preach. He was just really an extraordinary and humble servant and extraordinary civil rights icon. Not just for us, but for the entire country,
for the nation. And that's why I want more people to know about Reverend C.K. Steele, because he contributed greatly to Black America. Like, he was a real frontline fighter. He wasn't like a lot of people today. Just, of course, it wasn't available back then, but we have a lot of keyboard warriors today. But that Reverend Steele was out there in the trenches. And I think that more people should know about him and what he brought to the table, because of his relationship with Dr. King. And Dr. King spent a lot of time in Tallahassee as well. So we didn't learn anything about that. Like I say, when Dr. King came to Tallahassee, and I learned this from you, when Dr. King came to Tallahassee, he would oftentimes stay with Miss Laura Dixie and Mr. Sam Dixie. Mm-hmm. He would stay with them. Right. And those are the grandparents of my best friend. And it's crazy, because I've been around this man since the first grade and had no idea. Had no idea of like the richness of the history, even in his family in Tallahassee. So, and that's why, to me, that's why conversations like this is important, understanding and preserving Black history. So I want to get into, in the spirit of the preservation of Black history, I want to get into to educate people about Frenchtown and not Seneca Village, but Smoky Hollow, which is now Cascade Park. But before I get into that, people don't know about, you mentioned Reverend Aaron Good. You've mentioned him. Now, we've had conversations about him. You told me wonderful things about him. But can you educate our listeners a little more about Reverend Aaron Gooden? Because he was another important pillar in Tallahassee community.
Well, I remember the conversation that me and you had with Miss Dixie about Reverend Gooden. Mm-hmm. And it makes me smile because Reverend Gooden was a mentee of Reverend Steele, and they worked very, very closely together in the 60s and the 70s on the issues that were going on within the civil rights movement, also with the SCLC and the NAACP. But Reverend Gooden said himself, in his own words, he said CK played the moderate role, but I was not a moderate. And he said we needed CK and we needed me too. In fact, he said that shortly before he passed away. But Reverend Gooden was more of a he was more confrontational in his approach, and he I remember some of our local leaders saying that he was a tell it like it is kind of person. And because people knew that he was sincere, now his style, because his style was a bit more confrontational, he was not always successful, but people knew that he was sincere, and they knew that if Reverend Gooden was involved in an issue, that a fight was definitely on. He came to Tallahassee in 1961 to serve as pastor of St. Mary Primitive Baptist Church, which is at 454 West Call Street. And actually, he came when that was a wooden church. He actually built the structure that's there now, the brick church. And Reverend Steele and Reverend Gooden, you know, they were just different civil rights leaders who we had at that time. You know, when people would come from out of town to participate in civil rights marches and protests, a lot of times they would sleep at Reverend Steele and Reverend Gooden's house. They would sleep in the church on the pews. You know, you don't see that kind of stuff happening now, even though it needs to be happening now.
Right.
You know, they would allow people to come in and sleep in the church, and that they would have food. The community would come and bring food and all that kind of stuff. But 1961, Reverend Gooden he started out in Tallahassee as president of the NAACP Youth Council. Mm-hmm. He was advisor for the Youth Council. And slowly but surely, he got involved with every major civil rights organization in the South. Whether it be NAACP, whether it be Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he was able to prove his leadership skills and ability. He was able to work with, even in the 1960s, he was able to work with Governor Claude Kirk. If you go back and look at the newspaper articles that were published during that time, I credit Reverend R.N. Gooden with the state of Florida receiving its first Black judges and its first Black Supreme Court justice, because Reverend Gooden was, I mean, he was outspoken. And Governor Reuben Askew, who I'm a big fan of Governor Askew, because so many gains of African Americans were made during his tenure. But Reverend Gooden was on him hard. there are no Black, there's not enough Black police officers, there are no Black judges, we don't have enough Black elected officials, we don't have enough Black people in state government. When we gonna get our black judges? When we gonna get this? When we gonna get that? And so, I mean, literally months after his public press conferences and statements and meetings with the governor, we got our first black Supreme Court justice in Justice right. Joseph W. Hatchett. And we got the first our first black judge in Orange County and other places. And Dr. Doris Austin was appointed to the Leon County School Board, first black school board member. We started getting black folks in state government and on school boards, on city councils, all throughout the state. And so Reverend Goodness to be credited. And that's a part of the public record that, you know, anybody can go and look this up. He is to be credited with forcefully ensuring that we got African Americans in state government in the state of Florida.
Okay.
And let me tell you about Pensacola.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Goodman was born in Milton, Florida, which is about 30 right. minutes or so away from Pensacola.
Right. Right.
And he worked with, at the time, I think from 1970 to 1975, Reverend Gooden was the field director for the Florida State Conference, the NAACP branches. And so Pensacola was still rigidly segregated. And so the Reverend H.K. Matthews, who's still alive, he's in his 90s, and he is still out marching. He was out there with the Black Lives Matter. He was with the Black Lives Matter protesters with his mask on, sitting in his wheelchair with a megaphone, still marching at, I think, 93 years old, which I think Reverend Gooden would have been 93 years old if he was still alive. He was in they were in Pensacola. There was a young black man, Wendell Blackwell or Wendell Johnson, something like that, one or the other, who had been murdered. By police. And Reverend Gooden and Reverend Matthews, they led thousands. In fact, there are two separate books. It's two separate books that were written on this, because what Gooden and Matthews did in Pensacola was so significant, because, you know, here we are, we had all these laws passed and everything, and there were still active efforts to prevent people from voting, and a lot of stuff going on in Pensacola. So Reverend Gooden and Matthews, I mean, they filled up the jails. They right. had mass meetings, they had marches, and did everything they possibly could to. I think Reverend Matthews ended up going to prison because they said he had threatened the sheriff with some chant that they were doing in the church down there. But they camped out on the governor's lawn. They did a lot in right. Pensacola. Reverend Gooden and in fact the NAACP said that Gooden was too radical. Said that they wanted him to focus more on having meetings and negotiating than on protesting. And so he resigned from the NAACP, right. and the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who succeeded Dr. King as president of the SCLC, appointed Reverend Gooden as president of the Florida SCLC. And so he continued his civil rights work in Pensacola under the auspices of the SCLC. And actually, Reverend Gooden would remain as president of the state Southern Christian Leadership Conference, as well as the Tallahassee chapter, until he died in 2002. But throughout the 1970s, Gooden was responsible for additional black principals in the Leon County school system. He was responsible for black teachers being hired. And he really was a watchdog for the African-American community. If there was an injustice, if you called him on the phone in the middle of the night, he was there. If there was if somebody had complained that something happened, you know, he was there. There was people in the community knew who to call when they needed an advocate.
Right.
And that person was for 41 years in Tallahassee. That person was the Reverend R.N. Gooden. Whether he was needed to help a black mother who was dealing with her child having been slapped by a white coach, whether it was someone who had been raped, whether it was an injustice. Yeah. Going on in the police department, whatever it was, he battled every injustice that he saw, and of course that annoyed a lot of people, but that's what made him unique. He that's battled good. every injustice that he saw. He battled it every single one. He was relentless.
That's good.
He didn't have any fear at all. Reverend Gooden told you like it was, and he didn't think twice about it. So
see,
go ahead.
Yeah, now I'm just gonna say people like Reverend Gooden aren't taught. When me and my guest last week were talking, and we're reiterating it now. Black resistance, black uprising, black people fighting back is not taught. We have always fought back in some shape, form, fashion. I know that the docile nature of black folk, or black folk who chose to try to be nice with and friends with white people, those are ones that are shown to us and we'll talk about most of the time. But I keep encouraging people, study your own history, study our history. The further you dig deep, you'll see that people like Reverend Gooden existed everywhere. Black people always fought back, and that's one of the reasons why preserving and teaching black history is important. It's on us to tell our stories. That's why I exist, that's why the Latry exists. Like that's real, because Reverend Gooden was a bad man, and and like he, like growing up, like knew nothing about him. We only knew about the pastors who were active and alive at that point, but knew nothing about Reverend Good. So, two spots in Tallahassee. Gentrification has ramshack Tallahassee. Like, it's a small city. At our height, we could have 300,000 people, and that's because of college students. We have FAMU and FSU, Florida State University, Florida A&M University, and we have Tallahassee mm-hmm. Community College. We have a huge college population in Tallahassee. But Tallahassee, like I say, it's a real black and white city. Now, one of the anomalies on the, because we have a street called Tennessee Street, and we have railroad tracks on a street called Gang Street, and that's the divide from the north and the south side. On the north side, there was a historic black community called Frenchtown, and on the south side, there was a historic black community that's been wiped out and that's now a park. It was called Smoky Hollow. So, which one existed first?
Frenchtown is the oldest black neighborhood in the state of Florida. So, Frenchtown existed first.
Okay. So, let's go into the history of Frenchtown, because I know it didn't start off exactly as, you know, the black part of town or black neighborhood. But let's get the history of Frenchtown and how it became a black neighborhood, and then how it became what it is now. A gentrified community.
Well, Frenchtown started out in 1824. It was settled originally by the French who had come to Tallahassee. And when they moved out and after the Civil War in 1865, freed slaves settled into Frenchtown. And those freed slaves very against seemingly insurmountable odds, they built their own homes. They started their own businesses, and so every single thing. So with African Americans being shut out of other places, they didn't need to patronize other areas because we had our own in Frenchtown. Frenchtown was like a city in itself because everything that you needed was right there. There were hotels and boarding houses. There were nightclubs and restaurants. There were grocery stores and shoe stores and jewelry shops. There were schools and churches. Everything that you can think of, movie theaters, everything that you can think of, barbershops, hair salons, a pharmacy, a hospital. All of it was in Frenchtown, right between on Macomb Street, between Tennessee Street and Brevard Street, on those blocks. You had every single thing that you would need to have, and African Americans did not have a need to leave Frenchtown, which is why it was called the heart of the Black community for so long. And I would say the late 60s and early 70s started the decline of Frenchtown. The late 70s and early 80s is when you had a lot of the historic buildings in Frenchtown that were demolished, like the Redbird Cafe and the Laura Bell Memorial Hospital and the Chicken Shack, the Pool Hall. All these places that were so near and dear to the community were all torn down and demolished in the 70s and the 80s. Even Reverend C.K. Steele's church and parsonage at the corner of MLK and Tennessee Street, all that was torn down in the 70s to make way for the new church that's there now. I don't think we realized as a community in the 70s and the 80s when all this was going on, I don't think that we realized how we were erasing so much of our history at the time. And today you see a lot of gentrification that's taking place in Frenchtown. Like you see the student housing and these monstrous developments that have popped up as you drive through Frenchtown. So when you, my great great grandparents built a house in the 1920s on Virginia Street, and my great great grandmother's estate still owns that vacant piece of land right behind the Renaissance Center, and so it hits me different then it might hit some other people, because, you know, I ride through Frenchtown and I think about my great great grandparents, and I think about my grandmother, who was a nurse at the Florida A&M University Hospital, and she was trained in a LPN class at Lincoln High School, and eventually she got additional education and ended up being a supervisor of nurses. But when they closed down the Florida A&M Hospital, she ended up moving to Tallahassee Memorial Hospital. And then my great grand aunt, who was a teacher at the many of the small one room schoolhouses for Blacks that were in the county. Mm-hmm. And she was a nurse at the Laura Bell Memorial Hospital. And so I think about my legacy and my family when I drive through Frenchtown, and when I see that there's not much left. It makes me sad, but there are a lot of places that are still left, like, and I'm gonna point a few of them out, like the Took's Hotel on Virginia Street. When you had many of the famous Black entertainers that would come, like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, Lena Horne, James Brown, all of them would stay at the Ray Charles. Ray Charles lived in Frenchtown actually between 1940 and 1945. So Ray Charles,
right? Because he is from Greenville. Yeah, right. He is from Greenville. Right. Well, that's 45 minutes up the street.
That's right. And many people don't know Ray Charles lived in Tallahassee. You know that is in the Taylor House, which goes back to 1894, which was the birth home of Miss Aquilina Howell. The Working Women's Band House, which dates back to 1920s. The Getty Speed store. It's like one of the I think it's the last remaining wooden storefront in Frenchtown. The Modern Cleaners, that was which is where the NAACP is housed now. So there are a few properties left, and the original Lincoln High School also, which was the only black high school for blacks in Leon County for a long time. So there are several properties left that we still have to still tell somewhat of the story. But I would definitely love it if we had the whole community still standing where we could tell that story. I would be very happy. But see, then it becomes incumbent upon us. It becomes incumbent upon us because it's no longer there. We got to keep the story alive. We got to tell the story.
We do.
We have to create. We have to write the books. We have to create the institutions. We got to make the documentaries. We got to make the movies. We got to involve the people that need to be involved. We got to teach the kids. We got to, you know, that's our responsibility.
Right. Now, and what's interesting, though, as you described in Frenchtown, it was Tallahassee's black. It was, I would say, probably, Tallahassee's Black Wall Street. And a lot of people, I encourage everybody to do the history on your city, the black history on your city. Because I know we romanticize Tulsa, and Tulsa does deserve its due. But there were a lot of communities around the country, and probably in your own backyard, that was a booming community, its own Black Wall Street. So do your research and make sure you get into that. So now the next community is called Smoky Hollow. And one of the most famous people to come out of Smoky Hollow was Wally Famous Amos. And you know, the guy who invented the Famous Amos cookies. He's from Tallahassee, Florida, and he lived in the Smoky Hollow community. Smoky Hollow is now literally a park. Like, they knocked it down, and it's a park. And then they did their I guess you can say they preservation, their small preservation or display of some of the history of Smoky Hollow. But let's go into Smoky Hollow. Like, what was Smoky Hollow? How did it come about? And how did the gentrification happen?
Well, Smoky Hollow, it dates back quite a ways as well to the 1800s. It got its name because of the smoke that would come up from the small shotgun houses that were located there. And the smoke would come up because people were cooking. And there were actually some very prominent families to come out of Smoky Hollow as well. Lucille Holliday Brown, who passed away not too long ago, she was the first black librarian in Leon County. And you mentioned Wally Amos. There were some other well-known people in Smoky Hollow, probably the most prominent of which was John G. Riley. And actually, he owned some property in Smoky Hollow that he rented out to some of the African-American families there. Like you mentioned, the memorial that's there, but an actual piece of Smoky Hollow that was actually put back into Cascades Park is the barbershop, the small barbershop that's there that people can come in and visit. So where the Department of Transportation building is now, that was Smoky Hollow. Now, despite the fact that most of it is gone, Smoky Hollow is a National Historic District. And if you drive up Lafayette Street behind the Department of Transportation building, there are some small shotgun houses, maybe three or four small shotgun houses that are still existing from Smoky Hollow. So the community was not completely completely annihilated. Most of it was in the name of urban renewal in the 1960s. And a similar community that faced a similar fate, urban renewal fate, was a community called Rat Row. Rat Row was a black community.
I've heard of Rat Row.
That was a black community located where the Civic Center is now. Where the Civic Center is now, and that parking lot, there was an entire African American community there. That was a whole African American community that was destroyed in the name of urban renewal in the early 70s. So you got Smoky Hollow, you got Rat Row, Frenchtown, in North Tallahassee, off Thomasville Road, you had Carroll's Quarters, was a small black enclave there. Many other areas in Tallahassee that deserve mentioning. And when you see these black cemeteries, when you see these black these century old black cemeteries, either there was a slave plantation nearby, or there was a black community nearby. And out Mahan Drive, there's a cemetery, Munree Cemetery, and then you have another one by the name of Hickory Hill, out at Wilani Plantation that's being developed right now. That was a historic black community, and there are a few cemeteries out there, as a matter of fact, containing the bodies of black people. So really all right. over, out in the county, in the city, everywhere, you had these black communities that were significant and that were destroyed. But like I said, it's up to us to preserve that history.
Right. The last thing I want to get to is the importance of FAMU and how FAMU played a significant part in just the history of Tallahassee and just North Florida and the South. But how familiar are you with the history of the Union Bank that's on Appalachia Parkway?
Well, the Union Bank goes all the way back to the 1830s or the 1840s, if I'm not mistaken. After slavery, it was Freedmen's Bank. And so a lot of free slaves used it. It was a bank. It was a grocery store. It was a salon, I believe, at one point. And it was moved to its current location on Appalachia Parkway from Park Avenue. It's an extremely significant historic building that we still have standing in Tallahassee. It's owned by the state of Florida. It's been in use by the Black Archives since the 1980s. Uh-huh. And James Eaton, who was a professor of history at Florida A&M University, he was instrumental in acquiring the Union Bank because of its historic significance to African Americans. He was instrumental in acquiring it so that the Black Archives could alleviate some of its space constraints that it was experiencing at the time. But right. Union Bank or Freedmen's Bank is extremely significant, and it's one of the oldest surviving buildings that we still have in Tallahassee.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I know. We had an event there. That was one of our main hubs and main events for Black History Month, because I'm on the advisory board for the Black History Month Festival. And we use it a lot. So shout out to he gonna kill me. I'm looking at his face. Dr. Matt Ewan, yeah. Dr. Matt Ewan. I don't know his name, his face was right there, but shout out to Dr. Matt Ewan for keeping the Black history going with the Black Archives and with the Union Bank. So FAMU, Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University, is a historic university. It's like you mentioned earlier, a lot of the FAMU students have been involved in a lot of the civil rights movements and things that have happened in Tallahassee. You mentioned Jackson Patterson. There's a street named after both of those ladies off of FAMU campus. But what? How significant was FAMU to like the Black history of Tallahassee and the Black history of like North Florida or Florida period?
Well, FAMU came out of a bill that was filed in 1885 by Thomas Van Gibbs, who was a Reconstruction era state legislator out of Jacksonville. He was the son of Jonathan Gibbs, who was the first Black Secretary of State of Florida in the 1860s, following slavery. And Thomas Van Gibbs, who, because of the Jim Crow laws that were put in place in the 1890s, that ended his legislative career. But while he was still in the legislature, he filed this bill that created a white institution and that created a Black institution, the University of Florida and Florida A&M University. It was supposed to be located in Jacksonville originally, and Gibbs was supposed to serve as the president. But they ended up putting it in the state capital of Tallahassee and on a former plantation that was owned by former governor William Pope Duval. And he became the vice president. Interestingly enough, Thomas Van Gibbs's house is still standing on FAMU's campus. It's the oldest wooden structure still remaining on FAMU's campus. In fact, Gibbs Cottage is older than the Carnegie Library, which is where the Black Archive is located. So I think the Carnegie Library is dates back to 1909. Gibbs Cottage dates back to 1892. And Gibbs Cottage is one of the many historic African-American properties that needs to be restored and open to the public. You know, currently Gibbs Cottage, as old and as historically significant as it is, being the home of the founder of the university, is sitting on campus boarded up and unused, and has been for quite some time, since the 1990s. But that's an example of another property that we have to restore. But Florida A&M University has been significant to the state of Florida as a whole. Many African Americans who went on to make contributions in Miami and Jacksonville and Tampa and other places throughout Florida all graduated from Florida A&M University. A significant amount of them. And FAMU had the most socially conscious student body in America. And in many ways, that has continued to be the case. Even in modern times, that's continued to be the case. The student sit-in movement, as I mentioned earlier, the FAMU students were the first to go to jail and refuse to pay fines during the sit-in movement. They are the ones who voted to boycott buses, and when their students were arrested, and they had a mass meeting in Lee Hall where they all voted to boycott buses. And when the next bus came through campus, they got on that bus and told their students to get off, and then they rocked the bus and overturned it. So that's a significant. Brodus Hartley, who was student body president at the time, and Dr. Frederick Humphreys, who was president, who became president many years later, but he was a student at that time. They all tell that story often about how the football players turned the bus over when it came through campus. But FAMU has produced some of the most significant Blacks in the country. Congresswoman Carrie Meek, who was born in Tallahassee, but eventually went on to be elected to the Florida legislature as the first African-American female senator for the state of Florida, and eventually the first Black congressperson from Florida since Reconstruction. She's a Tallahassean. Even though she was elected from Miami and she's a FAMU graduate. She went on to work with Mayor McLeod Bethune and other people. Congresswoman Meek is she's still alive in Miami. Born in 1926 in Tallahassee, in a section of Tallahassee that was referred to as the Black Bottom, that off of Bruno Street, right off of FAMU's campus. In fact, they just placed a historic marker there. Right before the COVID-19 pandemic happened, there was a marker, a historic marker put in the ground to recognize Carrie Meek's parents, the Pittmans, who ran a boarding house right there off of campus. And FAMU was surrounded by those Black communities. The FAMU Way Extension, there were two significant Black communities that were in the way of that FAMU Way Extension. That was Stearns-Mosley community, and the Boynton Steele community. The Stearns-Mosley workers, as well as the Boynton Steele community, they were workers from the Alberta Crate Factory. So those were African Americans who worked at the factory, and then they built their homes in these communities on the outskirts of FAMU's campus. And then Bond is also a very historically significant community in Tallahassee. Bond was home to the Reverend King Solomon DuPont, who was one of the civil rights leaders and bus boycott participants. He was the first Black person to run for the Tallahassee City Commission in 1957. And he was pastor of Fountain Chapel AME Church. His house is still standing, though it's boarded up. It's in danger of being demolished, but his house is still standing on Diston Street. And there were many businesses and wash houses. Mr. Robert Perkins, so Robert Perkins Sr., he owned a gas station on South Adams Street, I believe it was, and he would fill up the cars of the carpool participants who were participating in the boycott. He would fill up those cars with gas. And he filed many anti-discrimination lawsuits in Leon County. And I think he worked at Florida A&M for a time. But there are many significant people at Florida A&M who were involved in civil rights, such as Dr. Charles U. Smith, Miss Daisy Young. Daisy Young, well, she was a firebrand. She worked at FAMU. But the students were becoming so involved in civil rights that the legislature put pressure on the president, Dr. George W. Gordon, to expel students who participated, which he did. And that's one of the reasons it took Patricia Stevens Due 8 years to earn her college degree. She started at FAMU in 1957, but she didn't graduate until 1965 because she was protesting. She was going to jail for the cause. And so, so she was expelled for a time, but she did eventually earn her degree. There were many other students who were expelled, but eventually earned degrees. So FAMU was significant in the development of Black communities in the 1920s and 1930s. And the university itself has gone through many significant changes. There have been many distinguished presidents, each of whom have had their issues individually. With it being a state school, you have to get funding from the legislature. You have to work with the legislature and the governor and other people. So it's been a difficult 130 years. For a variety of reasons, but FAMU continues to rise, continues to move forward. But it's extremely significant for a variety of reasons, a lot of which I probably won't get a chance to go into. But FAMU has been significant to the development of Black Florida as a whole. We had Coach Alonzo Jake Gaither, who was the most famous Black coach in America. He would hold his coaching clinics in Tallahassee, and Black coaches and white coaches would come to learn.
Yeah, Bobby Brown and them learn from him.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they would tell you that. Bear Bryant, yep. all these famous coaches, they came to learn from Coach Gaither. And I know I'm forgetting some stuff because there's so much when you
it's
talk about
good. Florida
University,
yeah.
but
oh let's but yeah. the hospital, because mm-hmm. what's interesting and what's funny, growing up, older Black people tell us were always like, you know, I was born at FAMU. And as a child, you like, what that, you know, I was thinking that that meant that FAMU was born in them. Like, they're real big, like, stout supporters of FAMU. I didn't know that they were literally saying, no, I was literally born at FAMU because the FAMU hospital was the Black mm-hmm. hospital at the time. So can you go more into that?
Sure. That hospital started in 1911. It was a wooden building at first. The current building, which is now the Foothillia Administration Center, mm-hmm. the construction of that building is to be credited to President William H. Gray Jr. and Dr. Leonard H. B. Foote, who was the medical director right. for the FAMU hospital. And so it was dedicated in 1949. The brick building is there now. But it was the only mm-hmm. hospital within a 150-mile radius, the only publicly owned Black hospital that would treat African Americans. So it was significant to Tallahassee and surrounding areas. Everything right. that they do at any other hospital was done at the FAMU hospital, because really that was our only option. The Laura Bell Memorial Hospital in Frenchtown was closed in 1956, I believe it was, after Dr. Campbell went to prison. He was accused of doing a botched abortion on a white woman. And right. he said that he did not perform the abortion, but rather he was trying to fix another doctor's work. And so he was imprisoned and ended up dying. And he was released eventually and passed in the 70s. So after that hospital was phased out, the FAMU hospital was the only one for the next 20 years thereafter between Tallahassee and Pensacola that served Black patients. And the significant and key players were Dr. L.H.B. Foote, Virginia Hillier, who was a nursing supervisor, and Dr. Russell Lloyd Anderson, who was also a medical director. Yeah. At the FAMU hospital. He was the first Black person to run for school board in Leon County. And okay. his medical office for a time was actually in the two-story building on Macomb Street that's connected to the Economy Drugstore. Dr. Anderson had his medical office on that top floor for a time before he moved it to South Adams Street when he was medical right. director at the FAMU hospital. And in addition to him right. being the first Black person to run for school board, Thurgood Marshall, when he came to Tallahassee, he actually stayed with Dr. Anderson, whose house was on FAMU's campus. And a lot of okay. the professors who lived on FAMU's campus did not want to risk having Marshall stay with them and risk potentially losing their jobs. But I think at the time, Dr. Anderson, he had his own private medical practice. So Thurgood Marshall stayed with him when they came to Tallahassee to fight a lot of the segregation cases that were going on. Mm-hmm. But the FAMU hospital was near and dear not only to Tallahassee, but to North Florida as a whole, because okay. That was the only place we could go. And it trained generations right. of Black nurses. It trained and employed generations of Black nurses. The FAMU School of Nursing did that. Yeah. And they were trained at the FAMU hospital. So
right.
Milliston Hollyfield is another significant mm-hmm. Person who was involved in nursing at Florida A&M University.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and I was actually I work with Neighborhood Medical Center, and our clinic that's on Ricketts High School's campus is named the Millicent Hollyfield. I think it's the clinic. And I was looking at the name today, and I was wondering who is Millicent Hollyfield, because once again we don't learn that information. But okay, so you just
She
gave us one of the nurses.
trained a lot of the LPNs. In fact, there is a picture of Millicent Hollyfield. She was the nursing instructor and a group of black female nurses outside of Jones Hall. It was taken on FAMU's campus outside of Jones Hall in the 1950s. My grandmother actually was one of the nurses that she trained, and she's in that picture.
Okay,
So Millicent
cool.
Hollyfield, she was a supervisor and an instructor of nurses at FAMU.
Right. Okay. All right, man. Man, you dropped a whole bunch of jewels on everybody's head tonight. Definitely appreciate you coming through. I know we could talk all night, but I got to get up. I think I got to wake up, what, 5:30 in the morning. We're doing some COVID testing tomorrow. So, but once again, I wanted to bring you on here so you can do just what you did, like give a lot of information. Let me move this so they can see your name. But the Latre Hollinger is his name. Blackpreservation.org is his website. The National Association for the Preservation of African American History and Culture. A young man who's been out here doing this thing. And you already know how it is with me and you. Whenever I got a platform, you just let me know when you're ready, when you're available. Because if I got a platform, you got a platform. Because I love what you do, and
Appreciate it.
the work just can't stop, man. It is what it is, man. Because got mad love for you and everything that you do, and we got to hook back up, man, and make sure we get some of these projects done that we started, and just make things happen. But once again, like I said, I wanted people to learn more about you. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and just I know you learned something today. I know you learned something today. Make sure you tell somebody about it. Make sure you spread his information. Blackpreservation.org is his website, the National Association for the Preservation of African American History and Culture. Make sure you all visit my website. It's www.ontheshouldersone.com, your home for African history. History at your fingertips, the stories of the sung unsung heroes of the African diaspora. And you can also support me on Patreon at patreon.com/OTSOG. Remember, tell a friend about this video, share it with somebody else. I know they can use the information. Make sure you comment, make sure you subscribe to this YouTube channel and hit that notification bell. And I'm going to continue to drop these jewels on y'all, continue to make sure I have great guests, continue to give information on this channel, because this is my baby. Once again, Delatry, you the man, and just continue to do everything that you do. And no problem. And for everybody else, we'll see y'all next time. So peace out.